The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay, thanks. So why study China in this time period, 1925 to 1927? I mean, I'm sure clear to everyone that China today is a major power at the center of world politics. I went to a talk this morning by Joel Geyer, where he said for the new generation of socialists that's coming up, the intensifying rivalry between the U.S., imperialist rivalry between the U.S. and China is going to be the defining issue for people who are coming up as radicals right now. China's the second largest economy in the world and growing, increasingly built up its military capacity and assertiveness. And as Trump has retreated into a nationalist, economic nationalist posture, China has offered to fill the gap of upholding an international order of trade and commerce. China today is also the site of stormy class struggles. The year 2016, just a couple years ago, was the peak of a recent strike wave, which saw huge strikes in construction, manufacturing, transportation, huge industries. Now, I say all this because the Chinese state today traces an uninterrupted history back to the revolution of 1949, when a million-strong peasant army under the leadership of Mao Zedong accomplished what has been hailed as the greatest national liberation struggle of the 20th century. Now, just in case it's not clear, this talk is not about 1949. It's not about that particular revolution. However, I think to fully understand the 1949 revolution, it's essential to understand events that took place 20 years earlier. When a mass movement of workers in the cities showed a very different way forward from that which was taken in 1949. I think more than that, the events of the 1920s are a study in revolutionary theory and tactics. What kind of revolution is possible, not just in an economically backwards country, but one that has been dismembered and dominated by foreign imperialist powers? Should the coming revolution limit itself to a struggle against imperialism, or could something even more radical and far-reaching be achieved? These kinds of questions pose an important corollary question: what is the role of revolutionary socialists in a national liberation movement? The way that the communists in China in the 1920s answered these questions really would be put to the ultimate stress test when a bottom-up mass struggle of workers and peasants challenged both foreign imperialist powers as well as the Chinese ruling classes who claim to oppose the imperialists. Now, unfortunately, I don't think it's a spoiler because of the title of the talk. This is a tragic story. These questions are going to be resolved in the negative sense. This is a story of a revolution that was defeated, betrayed by the leaders of a nationalist movement whom the communists were instructed to follow. And this would be a good time just to go ahead and say that I draw a lot on the work of this conveniently also titled The Tragedy of the Chinese Revolution, a book from 1938 called by Harold Isaacs. It's an incredible in-depth study of these events. Everything I'm going to say in my talk is just thumbnail, just a little bit of a sketch, and the book really fills out a lot of important detail and things that I'm not going to be able to touch on. Okay, at the dawn of the 20th century, the basic fact facing China was its domination and exploitation at the hands of the great imperial powers like Britain and France, and regional powers like Japan. This carve-up began in the early 19th century. This is sort of the classic golden era of imperialism. This is one description of the situation. The powers either appropriated or laid claims to much of the area along the coast, which was more accessible and more easily exploited than the interior. From the southwest, which was dominated by France, the Yangtze Valley, dominated by England, to the northeast, dominated by Russia and Japan. Great Britain controlled the Kaiping coal fields, Japan the Fushun coal mines, and Anshan iron mines. So that's just one little snapshot of the situation. Beginning at the start of the 20th century, foreign capitalist powers really own the lion's share of all the major industries in China. You know, all the big industries. China holds a massive held a massive trade imbalance with the great powers, affecting a drain of capital from China. In the big cities, you have foreign settlements or concessions, as they were known, that are carved out. These are territories just in, you know, another person's country that are controlled and policed exclusively by the foreign powers themselves. Now, all of this would have a serious debilitating effect on every sector of Chinese commodity. You have an influx of foreign Chinese society. You have an influx of commodities into the countryside and the peasant areas, disrupting the peasant area way of life. And by the end of the 1800s, this is causing mass dispossession, suffering for millions, incredible poverty, etc. At the beginning of the 20th century, you see the first stirrings of a modern nationalist movement when students, reformers start to raise aspirations of national independence from imperialism and for democracy. The old Chinese ruling dynasty, which has already been in a state of decay under the pressure of imperialism, collapses in 1911 after a military revolt. Now, with the old ruling dynasty gone, power now devolves into the mainly to local warlords. Warlords who have ties to whatever foreign power is dominant in their area. So you don't have any kind of real national power at this point that's opposed to the imperialists, and the grip of the imperialists tightens even further on China, and the conditions of life for peasants and the majority of society gets worse. Here's one description. Millions driven off the land begged, starved, took to banditry, or swelled the armies of the warlords. From the south, they steamed abroad to the Americas, to Malaya, and to the Indies. Millions clogged the cities and towns of the rivers and on the seaboard, an inexhaustible source of cheap manpower. The internal and external markets entered upon a disastrous decline. The whole economic structure rotted at the core. Okay. So, domination by foreign powers is not the whole story right now. China in this era also sees the development of its own industry and its own native capitalist class, or bourgeoisie, I will call it in this talk. This new Chinese bourgeoisie really emerges in the 19th century. It first emerges as sort of merchants and officials, then as compradores, literally just middlemen who are skimming off the transactions happening between foreign capital and the Chinese market. As industrialization begins to take root in the 19th century, and especially in the latter part of the 1800s, the wealthy of China start their own capitalist enterprises. So kind of starting in the 1860s, you have the first huge rice cleaning mills, Chinese-owned shipyards, modern coal mines, cotton spinning, weaving, metalworks, and so forth. Now, this nascent Chinese bourgeoisie, on the one hand, is really chafing at the ways they face unfair foreign competition backed by the imperialist gunboats. On the other hand, they are tied by a thousand threads to the existing status quo. So, for example, most of these new Chinese capitalists came from and were still attached to the old landed gentry. So, as such, they have no interest in like real land reform, something that would alleviate the situation of the poor peasants and that kind of thing. And as we'll see as the story goes on, the Chinese bourgeoisie's commitment both to profit and kind of this old unequal status quo will mean that their opposition to imperialism is not really rock solid. Now, the development of Chinese capitalism gets a big boost from World War I. You have all the foreign powers at war with each other. This kind of relieves the pressure of foreign capitalism. So you have a further spurt of industrial growth. Modern banking, modern corporate forms emerge within Chinese capitalism. Now, this growth of industry in China also spurs the development of a new class. This is the class of Chinese wage workers in the cities. And almost immediately, as they develop in this new industry, they begin flexing their muscles. By the end of World War I, the number of factory workers in China stands at 1.5 million workers. By 1927, that number of industrial workers, including factory workers, is almost 3 million strong, with another 11 million employed in handicraft work. Now, I'm going to skip the quote, but this young working class labored in just incredibly brutal and exploitative conditions. It's like Engels writing about the English working class, you know, in his time. It's 16-hour days, no hygiene, no safety, just totally brutal. In 1918, the first unions were formed, and by the 1920s, just the speed of this, by the 1920s, there are 3 million members in the Chinese unions. Shortly, by the end of World War I, they're starting to take strike action, and these aren't just bread and butter strikes, these are political strikes against foreign encroachment. So Harold Isaacs has a great quote describing kind of where things stand at the end of World War I. He says, "This rise in productive forces brought aspiring Chinese capital automatically into collision with entrenched foreign interests. It also brought the new class of workers into conflict with their employers, foreign and Chinese alike. From these new springs flowed fresh nationalist currents which swept China into the upheavals of the next decade." The spark is really lit on May 4th, 1919. There's a demonstration of 3,000 students in Tiananmen Square. It's a protest against Japanese imperialism, but also the imperialist accomplices in the local government. The government, over time, strikes back against this new student movement, and this really sparks a wildfire that spreads across China of this new nationalist movement. It's not just students, it's drawing in workers, poor folks, as well as merchants and officials who are coming out against foreign domination. This is the May 4th movement, and its growth at this point gives fresh stimulants to the Kuomintang, which is the nationalist party. It had been established in 1911. It's kind of the best known nationalist party on the scene. And as this new wave is taking off, it's actually pretty disorganized, not really a major factor in Chinese politics. But as the May 4th movement exploded, the party revived and grew, and it's animated by its three principles of nationalism, democracy, and people's livelihood. And these are all very vague kinds of categories that, you know, a lot could get potentially put into them. So it's into this rising tide of nationalist agitation that China's organized workers really, really, really step on the stage. And I'm going to read a long quote from Isaacs because it's so great. And it really captures how, despite its, you know, relatively small size and its youth, the Chinese working class and its actions were just electrifying what it was doing. So here's the description. In 1920, the Mechanics Union in Canton staged its first large-scale strike. And in 1922, the Hong Kong seamen electrified the entire country by winning a smashing strike over the British imperialists. In May 1922, the first National Labor Conference met in Canton under the triumphant leadership of the seamen. The conference united the delegates of 230,000 organized workers. In 1922, there were 91 strikes involving some 150,000 workers in all parts of the country. In May Day 1924, 100,000 workers marched through the streets of Shanghai, and twice that number in Canton. One leaflet read, 8 hours of work, 8 hours of education and recreation, 8 hours of rest. How reasonable this program is. The time has passed when proletarians are but cannon fodder for the bosses. They will not cede but to revolution, then they shall have it. And it's just, again, it's such good stuff, but again, it's so explosive, it's so huge, and in such a short period of time. In the year that would follow, the workers of Canton and Shanghai would take the struggle even to a higher level, to the next level, a level which poses the question of what group in society should lead a struggle that could kick out the imperialists and realize the aspirations of China's downtrodden masses. So now I'm going to pause this story, and I want to discuss the relationship between Soviet Russia and China's revolutionaries, and about the theories and debates surrounding the Chinese Revolution. Have a sip of water. The fates of the Russian and Chinese revolutions are completely intertwined, and that's not just because they actually share a border that people could cross, but it's because in the 1920s the world is still roiling in the immediate aftermath of the Russian Revolution. In early 1917, an uprising in the cities deposed Russia's old ruling royal family, and in their place there emerged an official government made up of the former liberal oppositionists, as well as a quasi-workers government based on the Soviets, which are bottom-up councils directly representing workers, peasants, and soldiers. After months of crisis, which saw the official government betraying the aspirations of Russia's lower classes, the Bolshevik Party led an insurrection that handed all power to the Soviet government. This was the first example of a historic, victorious workers' revolution. It sent shockwaves throughout the world and was a beacon of hope to the world exploited and oppressed. Now, Russia's revolutionaries, and Lenin would have been first among them, were very aware and explicit in saying that the survival of the Russian Revolution was dependent on the spread of the revolution to other countries. And in fact, after 1917, there was an outbreak of revolutionary struggles all across Europe and around the world. But by the 1920s, that wave was receding, and Russia was basically isolated. Also by the early 20s, Russia was emerging from a brutal civil war that had resulted in mass famine, death, decline of industry, the cities are abandoned, and the engaged and fighting working class that had been the basis for the Soviet system had been decimated. In its place did the old Russian revolutionaries grouped together as a ruling bureaucracy, kind of standing as a trustee for the worker state and until a future revival of the world revolution. So it's in this context of this double isolation that a section of the Russian ruling bureaucracy personified by Stalin, would become more interested in consolidating its stability and rule in Russia and would shy away from what it perceived as risky schemes to spread the revolution. In the context of a hostile world, this meant a search for any country that could potentially be an ally or a bulwark. In the 1920s, there was a struggle about this course. There was a struggle against the way the Stalinists were trying to push things, led by the remaining principled Russian revolutionaries, including Leon Trotsky. Now, this battle, this political battle inside Russia, is actually going to have huge implications for what happens in China. So you get that there's a huge debate, a fight happening in Russia, and then the way that plays out is going to impact events in Russia. Now, as I said in my introduction, there are two major interrelated questions facing the Chinese Revolution. Number one, was the Chinese Revolution to be strictly a struggle against imperialism? So right up until the Russian Revolution, most Marxists would probably have had the same answer to this question. And this owes to Marxism's commitment to an historical materialist analysis about the development of capitalism and the possibilities for workers' power. The argument goes, one cannot simply leap from pre- or proto-capitalist society to socialism because you first have to go through a stage of capitalism so as to develop productive forces and a sizable working class that can lead the struggle. Now, in the run-up to the Russian Revolution, Trotsky, among others, develops an innovative approach to this question, given the reality of global capitalism in the 20th century. Because of the phenomenon that we today call globalization, even the backwards countries were experiencing development of modern industry and the development of first sizable, if small, relatively speaking, working classes. These working classes would be imbued with aspirations that had it would be instantly imbued with aspiration that had taken the whole kind of history of the workers' movement in Europe and so on to develop. So, for example, it took European workers decades and decades to sort of arrive at the position where they said, we want the 8-hour day. The 8-hour day is immediately a slogan taken up by China's newly minted and combative working class. Trotsky's perspective about this is basically confirmed by what happened in Russia from the experience of February to October 1917. But Lenin first has to fight a huge battle inside the Bolshevik Party during those months because the whole theory of the party, right up until this point, still stated that only the bourgeois democratic revolution was possible, not a socialist revolution that could bring real economic justice. Now this question is being posed directly in China. Stalin and his co-thinkers have their minds completely made up. So this is a quote from 1922. It's a meeting of the Comintern, which I'll say more about, but it's the Russian delegate Radek is speaking to the Chinese communists. And he says to them, You must understand, comrades, that neither the question of socialism nor of the Soviet Republic are on the order of the day. The present state of China reminds us of the 18th century in Europe, especially in Germany, where capitalist development was too weak to allow the establishment of a united national center. Now, again, this is not just a scholastic argument, it's a pragmatic question. A revolution in China would greatly weaken the imperialist powers that were still threatening Russia. So the second big question posed here concerns the role of socialist revolutionaries and workers' movements in relationship to this nationalist struggle, which is led by capitalist and middle-class elements. Now, from the time of Marx, there's been a really consistent answer to this question. You can even go back to the Communist Manifesto. The duty of revolutionary socialists is to help ensure the political independence of the working class from other classes, whose interests are fundamentally opposed to the workers. They're fundamentally opposed in just the most fundamental economic sense. This perspective is also confirmed in the experience of the Russian Revolution. There were some parts of the Russian socialist movement who, in 1917, still looked to the democratic bourgeoisie to lead the struggle. In contrast, Lenin's Bolsheviks party grasped that the Russian bourgeoisie would prevaricate and flinch at the appearance of struggles of the lower classes that threatened their class interests. Accordingly, the Bolsheviks' MO was to constantly emphasize for the needs of the workers' independent action and to always be exposing, calling out the sellouts of the liberal bourgeoisie. Now, this question about the independence of workers' movements would get debated out more, specifically with regard to the national liberation struggles in the colonized world. After the events of 1917, the Russian revolutionaries launches the Communist International, or the Comintern. This is an attempt to sort of knit together the revolutionary movements of the world, and they have an eye on fomenting revolts in the colonized countries. The Comintern has a series of conferences. In the 1920 conference, they adopt the following position about the relationship between communist and bourgeois nationalists. I'm going to read this quote, really take it in, because when you listen to what they're saying here, it's 100% at odds. It just couldn't be more the opposite of what happens later on. The Comintern argued for, quote, the need for a determined struggle against attempts to give a communist coloring to bourgeois democratic liberation trends in the backwards countries. The Communist International should enter into temporary alliance with bourgeois democracy in the colonial and backward countries, but it should not merge with it and should, under all circumstances, uphold the independence of the proletarian movement, even if it's in its most embryonic form. Okay, you get that? It's pretty clear, right? I hope. Now, how does this play out in China? In 1923, envoys from the Soviet Russia, they make official contact with the Kuomintang. They pledge badly needed material support and training to the disorganized nationalist movements. In 1924, they negotiate an arrangement in which members of the Chinese Communist Party would join the Kuomintang by pledging individual allegiance to its principles and submission to its discipline. Thanks. Sun Yat-sen, who was the founder of the Kuomintang and its leader until his death in 1925, was really explicit in how he saw this arrangement, telling Russian diplomats, quote, if the Communist Party enters the Kuomintang, it must submit to the discipline and not criticize the Kuomintang openly. If the Communists do not submit to the Kuomintang, I shall expel them. And if Soviet Russia should give them secret protection, I shall oppose Soviet Russia. So the terms of this arrangement are pretty clear, right? Communists have to completely submit, and if they don't, all deals are off, and I'll be against the communists and Russia. The Chinese Communist Party had just formed. It formed in 1921. It was new, it was young, but quickly grew in size and influence in the heat of the workers' struggles of this period. It was almost immediately prevailed upon to join and subordinate itself to the Kuomintang. To explain away the bourgeois character of the Nationalist Party, Comintern officials declared that the Kuomintang was a, quote, block of four classes, workers, peasants, middle-class intellectuals, and the nationalist bourgeoisie. And in this schema, no one class predominates. It's just sort of this alliance of convenience, and according to supporters of this perspective. Now, while some leaders of the Chinese Communists really opposed this and really tried to protest this plan to submit to the Kuomintang, the immense prestige that the Russian revolutionaries held meant that they were able to browbeat the Chinese Communists to follow this course. Okay, another sip. It's May Day 1925. There's a massive worker-peasant demonstration in Canton. Canton is a stronghold of the Comintern nationalist movement. It's in Guangzhou province in the southern part of, Canton is now known as Guangzhou. It's in Guangdong in the southern part of China. It's right adjacent to the British-dominated district of Hong Kong. So that's May Day 1925. Weeks later, there's a shooting of student protesters in Shanghai, and this unleashes a whole new wave of protest all across China. There are big waves of protests, there's repression and shootings by the foreign powers, and that just spurs more protests, and so on and so on. By mid-June, practically all workers employed by foreign companies in the city of Canton are on strike, like all the workers. In June 1923, there's a mass demonstration, and it's attacked by British and French forces. 52 students and workers are killed, many more are wounded, and at this point, the thing really explodes. There's a declaration for a general strike, and it's a complete success. According to one account, Hong Kong, a fortress of British imperialism in China, was laid prostrate. Not a wheel turned, not a bale of cargo moved, not a ship left anchorage. More than 100,000 Hong Kong workers took the unprecedented action of evacuating the city and moved en masse to Canton. So it's British imperialism is set back on its heels instantly. It's like rock solid. Isaacs describes how in the course of this struggle, the workers were compelled to establish embryonic forms of workers' power. This is Isaacs. The movement was superbly organized. Every 50 strikers named a representative to a strikers' delegates conference, which in turn nominated 13 men to function as an executive committee. Under the auspices of this working class body, the first embryo Soviet in China, a hospital and 17 schools for men and women workers, was established. A striker's court was set up, which tried offenders against the boycott and other disturbers of public order. And that's just a short account. It did many more things, but you get the picture. This is embryonic, real workers' power, workers organizing society the way they want to see it organized. The foreign powers are completely set back on their heels, and on the strength of this mass struggle, the Kuomintang is able to consolidate its power in the region. At the end of June, it declares itself the national government in China, based there in Canton. Isaac sums up the situation at this point, saying, "Thus, in less than 2 years, a mighty mass movement had lifted the Kuomintang from the depths of political sterility and impotence to a position of power and prestige, which enabled it to challenge all the forces which stood in the way of its supremacy. All of this the Kuomintang had achieved thanks only to the mass movement of the workers and peasants. And the mass movement was able to develop its power and cohesion only through the enterprise and initiative of the Chinese communists." So in Russia, Stalin and his co-thinkers are intoxicated by this. They claim this the fruit of their policy that they had imposed on the Chinese Communist Party. In the beginning of 1926, Stalin co-signed a message to the Chinese Communists saying, "To our party," meaning the Bolsheviks, "to our party has fallen the proud and historical role of leading the first victorious proletarian revolution in the world. We are convinced that the Kuomintang will succeed in playing the same role in the East." So notice who he says is going to lead the struggle, not the Chinese Communist Party, but the Nationalist Party. In March of 1926, the Kuomintang is admitted into the Comintern as an associate party, and its new leader, Chiang Kai-shek, is elected to the Comintern's executive committee as an honorary member. The only member of the Politburo who voted against this is Trotsky. Okay, but not everybody in China is happy about this explosion of struggle. The Chinese merchants and businessmen of this region are absolutely hated this embryonic workers' power in Canton. While they initially applauded as the assault on British capitalism, as the strike committee's power grew, their business interests were impacted. Over in Russia, the Comintern leaders are getting more worried that this worker militancy would drive the Chinese employers into the arms of foreign business. It doubles down, instructs the Chinese communists to restrain the workers' movement, prevent what they call excesses. Nigel Hatters says this: "Stalin, now supreme in the Russian party, was not prepared to jeopardize the considerable Russian investment in the Kuomintang and its future role in safeguarding the eastern flanks of the Soviet Union, certainly not for a wild gamble on the possibility of workers' power. The movement had to submit to the demands of the Kuomintang and its business allies." March 20, 1926. This is just weeks after Chiang Kai-shek has been given honor, just weeks as after he's been given honorary membership on the executive committee of the Comintern, Chiang launches a palace coup to neutralize the communists and the labor movement. On the pretext of a left-wing coup plot, he arrests the Russian and Chinese communist advisors and declares martial law. He arrested the strike committee, ending any vestige embryonic workers' power and replacing it with military dictatorship. Within months, all civil liberties are suspended, the right to strike is suspended, and by October, the historic 15-month strike that had swept the Kuomintang to power was ended by the Canton government without a single concession made to the workers. Politically disarmed and constrained by the Comintern policy, the Chinese communists did nothing to protest the coup. In fact, on orders from the Comintern, they ended up making a formal apology to Chiang Kai-shek, saying that they had done bad things and gone too far and so forth. In Russia, news of the coup is basically buried. This is because Stalin doesn't want this news to get out. He's in this big fight with Trotsky, and if the news gets out, it doesn't look good for him. Okay, so that's Canton. Now we're going to talk about Shanghai, 1926. In July of 1926, Chiang Kai-shek begins a military expedition northward from China with the aim of taking control of central China. Now, despite everything I just said about it, the Chinese communists were just totally stabbed in the back, they nevertheless dutifully helped pave the way for the northern expedition, distributing propaganda, organizing unions, fomenting peasant revolts along the path of the northern expedition. In the provinces of Hubei and Hunan, workers' action is so powerful that it allows the Kuomintang to take over with barely a shot being fired. In November, the Kuomintang transfers its seat of government from Canton, which we discussed, to Wuhan. Wuhan is off the Yangtze River in central China, and Shanghai is to the east from there. In February of 1927, Chiang Kai-shek's troops are just 50 miles outside of, they've made their way north, now they're 50 miles outside of Shanghai. In anticipation of his arrival in Shanghai, the communist-influenced General Labor Union launches a general strike. And I didn't even write it. This is just an amazing thing that I don't have any detail I'm going to get into. It's a huge, massive success. 350,000 workers are on strike. It's just, I mean, just picture that. It's incredible. I can't even talk about it. Now, Chiang's troops end up purposefully staying outside the city while these workers on strike are besieged by murderous attacks from local police and gangsters and so forth, and over time the strike kind of dissipates. Now it's a month later, it's March 20. Chiang's forces are now just on the outskirts of Shanghai, but once again, stop, don't actually come in. The following day, the General Labor Union again calls for a general strike. This time, 800,000 workers go on strike. According to Isaacs, just about literally every worker in Shanghai. Literally every worker in Shanghai is on strike. That's how incredible it is. Having learned the lesson of the previous month's abortive rising, the strike is also accompanied by an armed insurrection against warlord and police forces. Armed workers took control of the police stations, military posts, telegraph, telephone offices, and by the end of the just one day, March 20th, resistance to the workers' rising had collapsed. Isaac says that by the time the nationalist troops had finally entered the city, quote, the workers had done their job. All of Shanghai, with the exception of the international settlement and the French concession, were huddled in hate and fear behind their steel and barbed wire. The workers had done their job. All of Shanghai, with the exception of the concessions, were huddled in hate and fear. The people in the concessions, they were the ones huddled in hate and fear behind barbed wire, but otherwise all of Shanghai is in the workers' hands. Along Paoshan, Paotong, and Cheongyang roads, the sounds of rifle fire gave way to the joyous crackle of fireworks and the shouts of workers celebrating their victory. The railway union issued orders for the repair of destroyed rail sections. The team of 300 workers organized to carry out these orders, and they were the first in all of Shanghai to resume work after the victory of the insurrection. Chiang Kai-shek finally comes into Shanghai on March 26, and at this point the workers are firmly in control. One more quote from Isaacs. More than 500,000 workers stood ready to guard what they had conquered by their own arms. At a word from union headquarters in the commercial press building or the Huchao Guild, not a working man or woman in the city would have failed to spring into action. Flushed with yesterday's great victory, they presented a formidable force. There was a provisional government set up which seemed to be in full communist control, which was ready to take over political power throughout the Shanghai area in the name of Shanghai's workers. I put that quote in there. That just gives you a feel for just how firmly in command of the situation the Chinese working class is at this point. The British and American communities are hunkered down in their settlements, terrified and suffering from what one writer described as a highly accented funk. Upon his arrival, Chiang immediately begins to plot the suppression of the workers. He's taking meetings and money with various Chinese gangsters. I didn't get into this. Chiang has sort of a weird past associated with gangster types in Shanghai, and also meeting with Chinese businessmen and so forth. Now, blinded by their policy of subordination to the nationalists, the communists blithely prepared the way for Chiang. In fact, they organized huge demonstrations to welcome him, welcoming him as the liberator of Shanghai, even though it was the workers themselves that had liberated themselves. Chiang is also, at this point, feted in the international communist press all around the world in communist publications. He's being celebrated. So, meanwhile, there's real obvious signs that there's a betrayal coming. I'm not going to get into it, but the Comintern leaders in Russia at this point go into overdrive to warn against any possible split of the communists from the Comintern. No less than Stalin himself weighed in on April 5th, 1927, and this is at a mass meeting. He's answering direct warnings from Trotsky about what's going to happen. And I read this quote, also pointing out that there's some really nasty racist and sexist language in here too. Stalin says, at a mass meeting, the Kuomintang is a bloc, a sort of revolutionary parliament with the right, the left, and the communists. Why make a coup d'etat? Why drive away the right when we have the majority and when the right listens to us? The peasant needs an old, worn-out jade as long as she is necessary. He does not drive her away. So it is with us. So that was Stalin, still in 1927. So according to this perspective, the communists dutifully begin their capitulation. They voluntarily hand over this provisional municipal government that they had created. They hand them over to representatives of the capitalists. They start to restrict straight actions, what pickets can do, and they basically hand over their guns. On April 12th, Chiang strikes out in earnest in what was a coordinated attack. It's launched out at 4 a.m. You have his gangster allies pouring out of the foreign concession areas, joining in with warlord troops, attacking working class organizations and headquarters. On that first day, 400 workers are killed. The workers' organizations did try for a last-ditch attempt to try to resist this. They call for another strike at a rising. 100,000 workers actually do respond, but there's total confusion over the situation. This is the guy we were literally just organizing demonstrations to support a few weeks ago. Now you're saying we have to stop him. So at this point, the initiative is completely with Chiang Kai-shek. On April 13, reactionary forces gunned down a mass march of men, women, and children, killing more than 300 people. And for all the talk of the Kuomintang's anti-imperialist bona fides, foreign forces are given the green light to go out and join in the slaughter. The reign of terror spreads across China. In all the towns and cities under the Kuomintang's control, or under Chiang Kai-shek's control, I'll say. And over the following months, tens of thousands of lives are lost. The trade unions are smashed, the present associations and the Communist Party are crushed. Charlie Hoare described the situation this way. The Shanghai Massacre utterly destroyed the workers' movement across eastern China and was a crushing blow from which it never recovered. It was such a mortal blow because it was delivered by Chiang Kai-shek, the very man whom Stalin and the Chinese Communist Party had built up as the leader of the revolution. The communists had delivered the workers' movements to him, bound hand and foot. The Kuomintang was able to impose their terror so effectively because the communists had disarmed, both physically and politically, the workers' organizations. Now, the crushing of the workers in Shanghai really is the most decisive act of this story, but I'm going to just briefly touch on a few more episodes, which time and again exposed the bankruptcy of the policy imposed by Stalin. After the Shanghai massacres, it's a little harder for Stalin to say Chiang is this great guy, the leader of the revolution. Now they switch tack, saying that the authentic left-wing revolutionary Kuomintang is the one seated in the city of Wuhan, and the communist task is to strengthen that government. Two communists join that government as ministers of labor and agriculture, the classic post of hostages, as Trotsky put it at the time. Now, in Wuhan, workers are still organized, still fighting in this town where this so-called left Kuomintang rules. But here, and also it's important that the peasants' movement is really surging and attacking the big landlords. Trotsky at this point is just out of fucks to give. He is very loudly criticizing the Stalinist policy, calling on the Chinese communists to break with this so-called left Kuomintang and to build up Soviets, is what Trotsky is directly saying. Instead, in order to appease the bourgeois landlord elements in the Wuhan government, the communists once again use their influence to rein in the workers and peasant struggles. In June 27, a left Kuomintang general begins a massacre of communists, trade unionists in Changsha, a nearby city. The Wuhan government follows suit, purging the communists, suppressing the unions and peasant associations. There's another horrible reign of terror. Tens of thousands are killed. With the counter-revolution now completely dominating the cities and the villages, and with the communists really reduced to just a tiny fraction of its former strength, Stalin's response is to say there's now a new upsurge, a new revolutionary rising. He orders a series of attacks known as the Autumn Harvest Uprising, in which peasant armies are supposed to attack strategic towns and spur a new national offensive. It was, of course, it was suicide, it was a fantasy, and this is now, the Communist Party is now just even now nearly extinct. Stalin had one final unbelievably cynical card to play. He is now, the fight inside the Russian bureaucracy going on in Russia is now reaching its end game. And because everything has gone so wrong in China, it's really kind of not looking good for Stalin. He needs a victory to silence his critics, so he just manufactures one. In December of 1927, which was going to be the opening day of the Congress of the Russian Communist Party, the rising of the Canton Commune is announced. In Canton, the very last city where the communists have any forces, the communists launch attack on the city center, and the workers there have no idea what's going on. They're just amazed that this is happening. It was just complete isolation of the working class. It's the total opposite of Shanghai earlier that year. And within days, it's crushed, and there's another reign of terror. Isaac's called this a bloody sacrifice imposed from above, and it served its purpose for Stalin, though, because he was able to say, hey, look at this, there was this big insurrection, and that's what allows him actually to finally defeat the opposition in Russia and take absolute power. The final defeat of the Chinese Revolution marked the last of the revolutionary upheavals inspired by the Russian Revolution, and its outcome seemed to confirm for the international communist movement that Stalin's plan for socialism in one country was now the only way forward. Stalin had secured absolute power both in Russia and in the international communist movement on the bodies of untold numbers of workers and peasants in China. So just to conclude, those who opposed Stalin's policy said that despite, you know, the Marxist schemas of the past, the Chinese bourgeoisie would be incapable of fulfilling its democratic tasks and liberating China from imperialism. According to this argument, Chiang Kai-shek's tyrannical Kuomintang would be caught in a dilemma between, on the one hand, saying you're against foreign powers, and on the other hand, maintaining the class interests of the Chinese capitalists and landlords. This analysis was proven 100% correct, with tragic results. As Mao Zedong took the surviving communist fighter out in the wilderness of Western China for a 20-year sojourn, the Kuomintang was never able to actually unite a true national government. Outside, it declared it was the national government, but outside the cities, China is still dominated by rival warlords. And in the 1930s, when Japan invades, Japan is easily able to sweep in and take over parts of the country. After the war with Japan, when Mao's army was able to, this is after the war with Japan, and Mao's army is directly taking on Chiang Kai-shek's forces, the Kuomintang at this point is a corrupt, hollow, demoralized, lacking legitimacy, and is just basically defeated in 1949. The price of the defeat of the first Chinese Revolution was 20 years of misery and oppression at the hands of imperialism and the Chinese bourgeoisie, and a very different outcome in 1949 from the possibility seen briefly in 1925 through 1927, the possibility of workers directly taking their destinies into their own hands. I hope this talk has helped illustrate not just the tragedy of Stalin's policies, but their absolute criminality. And more than that, the tragedies of the 1920s should be an object lesson, one of the most important things we say all the time, the need for socialists to secure the absolute political independence of the working class in the struggles to come. Thanks.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.